Okay, we are live. Hello, everyone. My name is Alex Mason. This is Investment Banking Insights, and I'm here today with special guest Matthew Farquhar. Thank you so much for joining me, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yes, and I'd love for you just to begin by telling us a little bit about what you do and your own personal story, because I think it's very interesting and helps explain kind of where you're at now.
Awesome. Well, I tend to ramble here, so just stop me if I do. But, you know, I'm Matthew, so I run a business called FR Consulting, and really it's sort of a coaching service, and it helps students break into the capital markets and to, you know, the competitive roles that you've heard, investment banking, private equity, hedge funds, all that stuff. And really the impetus for it was that when I was going through recruitment myself, I found many things that I eventually figured out to just be like behind closed doors, to be gatekept for, you know, no particular reason. And for many things in the recruitment process or what you must do as a candidate that I had to figure out through trial and error. And it just, to me, seemed like a black box. Now, when I eventually joined a couple more clubs after I'd done all the recruitment stuff, I realized that much of the information was, being held by certain groups and only shared with certain people. And I think that's fine. But as an industry that prides itself on meritocracy, I think that giving the information away as best I can, or leveling the playing field was something that I felt really passionate about. And so, in terms of like my story and how it all sort of came together, so I grew up in Singapore, and I, after the military, came to Canada for university. And going into it, I was like, my dream was to just work on Wall Street. I'd read, you know, a couple books and stuff, had like, finance, the stock market. So I had no idea about like what it really was and all the different roles within it. Now, eventually figured that out and quickly settled on investment banking, probably like within 2 months of freshman year. And then, for the rest of university, just literally that's all I focused on. And my whole life was ordered around recruiting and pursuing that dream. Now, by, for my penultimate summer recruitment, eventually landed, investment bank in the US. And that was something I was like, oh, finally. But then I kept recruiting and didn't really know why and didn't question it either. And in the month leading up to that internship that I landed, realized that, okay, maybe this isn't what I wanted to do. Not that I wasn't passionate about finance, like I love it, but entrepreneurship was something that I always pushed away and like, I'll do this first, I'll do that first. And I was like, why don't I just start now? And so quickly sort of like started, doing research and all that stuff, eventually landed, my first client inadvertently during that internship, in fact. So I was like, okay, this can work. And so it was something that I've been doing for the last 3 years. I was like, this is what I can do. And then, one thing led to the next, and FR Consulting was born.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you, Matthew, for that overview of your story. So you pretty much knew you wanted to work in Wall Street, weren't sure exactly where you wanted to go in that. And eventually, of course, now you've come around to entrepreneurship. But in between there's this period where you're learning, you're recruiting, you're doing all the things that you need to do to land your investment banking internship, and you were successful. So I'm curious, what was it about investment banking in the first place that attracted you to the field?
I think that's a great question. And something that many students battle with, I think, throughout university, like what should I do and what is right for me? And I think the hardest part about determining that is you can only do that after the fact. And so for as roles competitive as, the ones in the capital markets, it's like you have to deal with that uncertainty and you have to commit without knowing whether or not it's right for you. Now, why I committed to investment banking was, I think, reasons that most students have in that, initially it was the prestige of it and the money that it came with. That was what sort of just got me interested. Now, as I dug into it more and got superficial interest turned into something deeper, I realized that investment banking would be the job that provides a platform for me to, one, understand the capital markets and you know, all its sort of different facets, but also give me access to all those sort of different facets in the capital markets, all those opportunities. And so it was a weird sort of, coming out of university, usually your scope and what your career scope narrows, but with investment banking, it seemed to expand. And I think that dynamic and the fact that it wasn't really found in really anything else except probably management consulting and business, that is, was what really attracted me. I was like, okay, well, if I do IB, then I can do all this other cool stuff too. And so that was sort of what I think kept me going the whole time.
Thank you for that, Matthew. That's helpful, because I think a lot of people who are just starting on their journey are hearing about banking. They're kind of interested in it for one reason or another, like you said, either the compensation or the prestige, but there are deeper reasons why people stick with it. And I think it's important to highlight that so that we understand exactly where everyone's coming from in this recruiting process. And definitely, I totally agree with you there. There's so many options that can open up for you as a banker. And even if you want to stay in banking, there's a lot of amazing opportunity there too. So that's great. So, okay. So you successfully recruited, but I know that you had many, many, many failed coffee chats and other experiences before you actually got to that point. Tell us about what that experience was like. What's the story behind your recruiting journey before you got your first successful banking internship?
Yeah. So it's definitely something that I look back on a lot and certainly consider a big transformation, like in my life and what I learned throughout it. But I think if we start all the way from freshman year, so coming out of the military, and I'd been in for 2 years, so I had no like job experience except for working at like a Japanese restaurant as a waiter. And so coming into university, I was like, dude, I'm going to get an internship. Like, I know most first years don't get internships, so I'm going to do it. And just applied to stuff, like just applied, didn't do anything more, just did resumes, cover letters. And I probably did, you know, like hundreds of them in first year. And nothing much came of it. So that was pretty hard to deal with, because I was like, well, all my other friends are not applying as many jobs as me. And like, I think I'm doing everything right. Like, I'm following what my career center says. Just got no results. And it wasn't even like I was applying to prestigious or like competitive roles. Like, you know, I get turned down from like admin jobs as well. So I was like, what the heck? And I was lucky enough to have emailed like all the private equity firms in Vancouver, just like as sort of a last ditch attempt towards the end of the first term, my first year, and then got an internship based off of that. So joining that was, I think, really, really beneficial. I didn't realize at the time, but it did set me apart in terms of just what I looked like on my resume. But I continued applying. And it was in April, at the end of April. I remember I was crying to my parents one night because I had applied for the last 8 months to jobs and got a nothing except that unpaid private equity internship. And they're like, well, you just got to keep going, man. And I was like, oh, my. So still no summer internship. And I basically settled on like a call center job. But the next day, my friend told me that he got an accounting internship at a firm downtown. Go downtown, interview, because they were looking for another intern, and I got it. I was like, holy. Well, I wish I had the connections that he had. But did that accounting internship. Now, obviously, that's not as relevant to investment banking as I would have liked. And so throughout the internship, because I knew that firm had a corporate development team, started like networking with them during lunch and after work, talking to them, basically trying to build like a network within that team, and then eventually was able to get some mandates from it. Then continued working part-time there into the subsequent school term of my sophomore year. Now, going into sophomore year, I was like, dude, I'm going to be fine. I got two relevant internships with more than most other people. Like, let's do it. And I took it more seriously too, because like I was going to introduce coffee chats. That was the new tactic, networking. And did that, nothing much came from it. I was just applying to the wrong jobs, honestly. Still didn't know too much of just about like networking and how to apply and the process of doing so, and the most efficient way of doing so. And so came up against the same wave of rejection for the next 3 months. And then in December, I had won a case competition, like a regional one in Vancouver. And it was at EY firm. and then network with them. You know, I'd done so many coffee chats over the last 3 months. It was like kind of just normal. I was like, okay, maybe this will come to something. And so of the seven judges, four replied. You know, of the four, one gave me an interview, and then that interview led to another interview, it led to another interview, and then I got it. And so in December is when I got that sophomore summer internship. And then 2 weeks later, started the penultimate one as well. And during that time, I joined another private equity firm, like a search fund, to do part-time. So I was working two part-time jobs on school and then recruiting. And so I think that gave me a level of like tolerance for, you know, a lot, like a high amount of work or demanding amount of work. And so recruitment and that 30-year recruitment cycle, which is typically very, very stressful for second-year students, I've basically done that for the last, you know, 4 to 8 months. So not that it was easy, it wasn't, but again, probably like from January to April or March, sorry, probably sent like 1,000+ emails to the US. Response rates were like, you know, in the single digit percentages, like low single digits. And like, I'm glad I had sort of thickened skin from the last sort of wave of rejection. And then basically, got like 3 interviews. One was successful. And then that was Melissa. And so, yeah, it was, I think the most amount of rejection came in the outreach, the cold outreach and the networking. But, what I realize now is that that's just part of the game. Like there were people who had been doing it longer than me, who had been recruiting and focused on that stuff longer than me. And so like, it would be unreasonable for me to expect, you know, accelerated success because I hadn't been preparing like as long as that. And I see that now with like many students. It's like they get their first rejection. It's like, oh no, like the world's over. It's like, dude, like you're going to face about 50 to 100 more no's until you get one yes. And that's just the nature of the game. Like it's highly competitive, it's highly paid. And so, yeah, you got to be 99th percentile. But yeah, sorry for the ramble. That was sort of the story of it.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you. There's a lot there. And I think we can maybe take a couple minutes to unpack some of it. So it sounds like your first success was really in this accounting department at a firm. And that was through networking with peers at your school. Is that correct?
That was networking with, so I had a friend, it was just fortuitous in that way. Like, and he had landed an accounting internship and he was like, though they're looking for another intern. So joined their accounting team, but who I was networking with was the employees on the corporate development team. So a completely different team than what I was on. But I was interested in finance. So I basically just like read about their deals and then walked up to them at lunch. It was like, hey, are you guys like in corporate development? They're like, yeah. It's like, oh yeah, I'm interested in investment banking. And I've seen like you guys have done this and that. And so just sort of like tried to talk to them and show my interest essentially. And I think at that point, that was the bar to meet. Just like there are no other first years walking up trying to show their interest in transactions. And so I think I stood out in that way. But yeah, that was sort of the first networking success.
That's awesome. I love that because you had an initial opportunity. It wasn't really what you wanted, but it was close enough to where you could get in the same room as other people who were doing things closer to what you were really trying to do. And so just actually walking up to people at lunch and introducing yourself and having a polite conversation, showing that curiosity, showing that interest can go a long way. And I think your example is proof of that. So you kind of, you got that down. You ended up also doing this, sounds like unpaid private equity internship, which is amazing because a lot of people, I feel like they would kind of scoff at any unpaid internship, unfortunately. Like I've done an unpaid internship before and it was a huge experience booster for me in my career journey. And I'm sure that was for you too. So it sounds like within the first 2 years, you're really just kind of stacking up these experiences as much as you can, even though you weren't necessarily breaking straight through to the IB job right away, you were building those networking skills. And of course, doing all the other things that everyone expects you to do, right? Like sending out emails, studying your technicals or what have you, understanding the market. And so then let's talk more about this transition. So you've worked for a couple of years, you're juggling the part-time jobs while you're a student, and now you've got a couple of things on your resume, right? So at that point, was it your junior year you decided, okay, like I'm going to get the banking internship this year? And how did that story go?
So I think the idea that I wanted the banking internship was definitely in freshman year, and then everything that came after that was in pursuit of that. So those experiences I just talked about were all throughout first year, the unpaid private equity one, and then the accounting and corporate development. That was first year, I think winter term or fall term, and then the summer. And then coming into second year was like, okay, I need to get my second year summer internship because I want to recruit as early as possible for that banking internship. So in terms of that transition and when I sort of like buckled down to just go right after investment banking in the US, it was around December of my sophomore year. So right after the fall term had finished, right? And I knew that because I talked to upper year students and they were like, well, US recruiting is earlier than Canadian recruiting. And so you have to be ready earlier. So I was like, okay. And that was why I was so rushing so hard to get that sophomore summer internship secured as fast as possible. Now in terms of like that transition, what happened? It was really just like, okay, well, after speaking with upper year students who had gone to the US and there were only a handful, they were like, yeah, you got to network like crazy, man. And everything has to be stellar because you're from Canada, you're at a non-target university, and you don't have any like big brand names on your resume yet. Besides like, EY, and that wasn't even like that related to investment banking. So, I was sort of like, okay, I just took that and ran with it. And so, knew that the way that I was going to get better and reach that stellar level was just through quantity. Because many of the things in recruitment are like, there's no feedback loop. So like you fail a coffee chat or it doesn't lead to a referral, you're not told why. You fail an interview, it's like, you're not really told why. Right, the feedback they give, as if you've got it before, is not the best. So I was just like, okay, well, let me just make my own sort of like feedback loops and like try to just learn as much as I can from it. So like before I ever started coffee chatting for the US, definitely like just coffee chatted people that I didn't really care about, like of no consequence to me, just to get the reps in. And I'd done that, throughout second year as well, or the prior term. So I was aiming for like, probably like 100 chats cumulatively before I ever talked to bankers in the US. And so that was one of the things that I changed. And then it was also like, well, I'm going to wake up earlier and email earlier because they know I'm on the West Coast. And if I'm emailing people on the East Coast, then I can make an impression, get that little bit of an edge if I'm replying to them at like 9:30 their time, 6:30 my time. So that was another thing. I was like, okay, well, let me get that edge. And then it was sort of like, okay, well, I have classes that I need to go to, but I also knew that that term's grades weren't going to be represented on the transcript or resume that I sent in my applications to those banks in the US. So, and I knew that like last term too. So I had really tried hard with grades, but I was like, do this term, I don't even need to go to class. So I didn't go to class. Now I still did like okay with my grades and stuff, but I was like, I gotta eke out any time that I can to dedicate to recruitment. And though I didn't realize at the time, looking back, it was just like, dude, it's a competition and you just got to train harder and train longer and more often. And so getting all the reps in and just sort of steeling my mind and not reading into any rejections or any no's was what really helped me get through that period of time. Because yeah, like 95% of the time it was like a no or a rejection. And if that was my first time ever dealing with it, hadn't done it in the prior term or first year, I don't think I would have lasted as long as I did. So I think the main things that changed was like I got to school earlier because I woke up earlier and sent emails earlier. I sent more emails because I knew that coming from where I was coming from, I was just not going to be it wasn't going to be easy for me, and I just needed to win with volume. I
How many
practiced.
were you sending? How many emails were you sending a day or a week, would you say?
I was probably sending at least 100 a week. Now, I was mistaken on some, like I didn't do it right in for some firms. Like I would just blast 20 analysts at like PJT's New York office, and I never got any replies. And now I know why. But yeah, it was about 100 a week.
That I was reaching out to everyone in the organization, analyst, associate, VP, any email you could find, pretty much you were cold emailing.
Pretty much. I mean, I know, to always start with as junior as you can. And I'd say even below analyst, ex-intern or current intern, because as you move up that hierarchy, the person you're talking to has more influence, but the chat itself is also more difficult because, like, dude, 40-year-olds don't care about a 20-year-old. Like, what are you going to talk about? So talking to MDs and VPs, it's best to come to that with ammunition gleaned from prior chats with juniors. And then you can also buff up your email or your outreach with, like, hey, I've talked to these people. I'd love to get a different perspective on the team and the firm. And oftentimes when MDs receive an email, they'll refer down. And so, like, they're like putting you in touch with like Alex, and then like it's like an analyst. So that prevents that from happening. So you get the chat and you come off as more prepared and more interested in that firm because you've talked to other people and you have the ammunition that you can use to ask questions on those calls. So there were some last ditch attempts in terms of like if I knew that the interview or like the interviews are going to be sent out soon or the application is going to close soon, I would just like, frick it. Let me get all the senior MDs, all the VPs, and just like blast them. It worked for one firm, Evercore. Now I talked to like 10 juniors though from the New York office, but that was sort of the strategy at the time. Work my way up. And if it's like near crunch time, who cares about the hierarchy? Let me just email everyone I can.
Got it. Okay. So working your way up tended to be more successful. It makes sense, right? The people lower in the organization typically have more time. They're a little bit closer to the experience that you are experiencing in the present moment as someone recruiting. So there's a little bit more of a connection there. What else did you do in that process of getting on the road that ultimately led to the Moelis internship? What other things did you do other than sending the emails and your approach of doing the coffee chats? What did you learn? What other kinds of things did you put in place that worked for you?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question. I think what I did was like, I held myself to very high standards for anything. So a behavioral answer, right? So there are certain constants in coffee chats that you can predict. And the reason why I'm talking so much about like coffee chatting networking is like, well, one, a coffee chat is not just a coffee chat. Like it involves many other aspects of technicals and behaviorals, and I'll get into that in a second. But the first round interview is when you're evaluated on a blank slate. So to get to that point is really the hardest part of it. And so everything that comes before that first round interview, well, yes, is your application, your resume, all that stuff. Much of that is immutable at the time of the application, but what isn't, the rapport you've built with people on the team. So networking itself is like very, very, very important. Now, the coffee chat and to get into what exactly I was doing was, you know that there's going to be an introduction. You know that there's going to be transitions. You know that they're going to talk about themselves and that they're from this firm and they talk to other students too. And so I think the thing that I realized was that I'm not evaluated just sort of this chat itself is evaluated independently. I'm evaluated on a relative basis to how that person felt about other students' chats. And so that helped me realize that, okay, well, even if I can't find anything on their LinkedIn as material to ask questions, other people can't either. And so if I take the extra 30 minutes to go and do research into their high school or just Googling and going to like the 10th page, something will come of it. And even if it doesn't look like substantive to them, they've probably never heard it before. And so I look different from everyone else. So just sort of continuing to go back to that frame of like, well, if I can't find anything, other people can either. Most people would stop. Let me continue. And I think that really helped edge out the competition. And this is all blind to me. Like, I don't know. This is just sort of my perception. But it's also something I've seen through the students that are now currently in my program. The other thing would be putting a lot of emphasis on those constants. So like your introduction, like I think a good way to think about it is every single person who's ever going to give you anything when it comes to a job offer, an interview, whatever it is, a referral, they're all strangers. And so if they're all strangers, the one thing that really matters is your first impression. And so what comprises your first impression? How you introduce yourself. And so that kind of made it click for me that, okay, well, my introduction is probably the most important question or a thing that I'm going to say throughout recruitment. And I'm going to use it for every single person that ever encounters me, that I ever interact with, and every single evaluative sort of setting begins with me introducing myself. So putting a lot of emphasis into the vocabulary that's in it, the exact timing of it, having a 30-second, 1 minute, 1 minute, 32-minute version of my introduction, of making sure that every single word had meaning or every single sentence had meaning, and that I was conveying the traits I wanted to convey. And that required a lot of self-reflection, but luckily enough, I had a slightly unique background of going to the military, growing up in Singapore, and so I really leveraged that. But then the last thing that I also want to mention is like something that I think really moved the needle for me was just sort of like getting the reps in, like just putting more time in than other people. And it's not like, I'm this and they're worse. It's more like, okay, well, use your peers as the reference point for how good you need to be. And so it's like, okay, well, if only one or two people from UBC every year go to the US, well, there are 20 people recruiting for investment banking right now. I need to be better than all of them. And so I need to be put in more time than all of them. Because statistically, like that's what would allow me to have confidence and conviction in saying that, yeah, I'm going to get an offer from the US. So seeing my peers and then just like always doing X plus 5, X plus 10, X plus 30, whether that's hours, that's coffee chats, that's pages you read, questions you do, that was what I focused on. And so continue to reevaluate where I stood relative to them, and just to make sure that I was always doing more. And I think over time, that really helped, especially in technicals and in the vocabulary that I had. Because if you sound like a banker, they think that you're probably a banker or could very well be one. And so the vocabulary really, that just comes from reading over and over and over again. I think for anyone who recently joined finance or capital markets, you know that the terminology hump is a big one to overcome. But once you overcome it, it's everything kind of clicks. So just continuing to sort of build up that base of this is how you describe this, this is the correct way to say that, I think really helped sort of make their impression of me, whoever I was talking to, as, oh wow, this is a serious candidate. He's been doing this for a long time, therefore deserves a first round interview.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you, Matthew. That was a lot of great insight there. And on that last point regarding getting the reps in, I completely agree with you. I think it's so important, especially for candidates who don't have a finance background at all, like I didn't. And it's just a really big thing to get over that hump. And it feels so foreign when you're getting into it. You're reading about all sorts of terminology, you're reading the Wall Street Journal, other publications, just trying to soak it in, but it's not sinking in yet. And I think we can both encourage the listeners out there right now, like it will sink in if you just keep at it and keep exposing yourself to new ideas. Because the cool thing is when you expose yourself to the same idea from different perspectives, you get just a little bit more insight than you did before. And then eventually the pieces start to fall into place. So I really think that that's a great point. So what were you doing in terms of, you mentioned technicals, in terms of technical prep, how did you approach it? I mean, did you just crack open breaking into Wall Street and start at page one, or did you do other things? Did you do everything? tell us what that preparation looked like for you.
Yeah. I think everyone starts with the Breaking into Wall Street guides in some form or another, whether that's the 400 questions or, like some other guide that's based off of the Breaking into Wall Street guide. So you know, everything flows from him, from Brian DeShare, I guess. But I think it's I will sort of say that I did start technicals in my first year that summer. Like, I read the 400, mocked with a friend. We did like weekly mocks throughout it. So I was okay. Then into second year, sophomore year, that first term kind of stopped because I was recruiting a lot more heavily and doing a lot more networking. So really only resumed technical prep, and I've probably forgotten everything that I learned in my freshman year in December. So like when I kind of made that transition to looking for that banking internship in the US. Now, in terms of like how I approached it and what I did, I think one thing that is immediately obvious when you look at the Breaking the Wall Street, or the 400, is like, dude, there's a lot. Like the 400 question, like no one's probably seen that like 400 question for like a science or math or something like that. So there's a lot to go through. And something that I see now with like many students is like your brain always overestimates how fast you can do things. And underestimates how long it'll take to actually understand everything. And so I think that there's a implicit sort of misalignment between how long you think you need to master the Breaking Into Wall Street guides and how long it actually takes. So knowing that because I had done it in freshman year, I knew that, okay, this stuff actually, like, it takes a while. And it's gonna take many, many, many hours. And so what I kind of like approached it with is like, okay, well, how do I be efficient? Like, when you reread a guide, like, what's the inefficient part of that? Well, it's when you're reading information you already know. It's like, okay, well, why don't I just make a list of the things I don't know? And then just focus on whittling that down over time. And so I was aiming for about 3 to 4 hours every single day of reading them, rereading them, annotating, taking down notes, and then like testing myself on the questions. And so kind of basically would do one round of Breaking Into Wall Street guides, take the notes on the stuff I don't know and which page numbers, which questions they were, test myself on the questions at the back, all that. Then I would look at that, reread it, or like basically the select the parts of the guide that I didn't understand, try to do it and like flesh it out and really like analyze it from different perspectives. As you're saying, the same thing looked at from different perspectives really helps understand the full sort of depth of it and all its different sort of aspects. So that was another thing that I did. And then just focus on that document as like, okay, well, how do I get this to be smaller, 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 smaller? Now, the problem that I eventually ran into was that all the questions that I could test myself on, I already had test myself on like one or two or three times. And so there was a lot of like, just, I read the question, I already know the answer. So, I mean, now what I would do is I'd go on ChatGPT and ask him to change all the numbers. But at the time, what I was doing, I'd either change it manually or I just go to the, like, I would ask everyone that I knew for other sorts of guides out there. And I did manage to get my hands on a few, but I think exposing myself continually to other questions, harder ones, more advanced ones, really helped ingrain the stuff in me. And I think the last thing, or probably second last, is regular mock interviews. And so I read this book on like how to study efficiently, how to learn efficiently. It's like there's the like sort of digestion of the information, and then there's the testing of it. And so ordering sort of my week in accordance with that, where like Monday through Wednesday was reading and understanding. And then I would do a mock interview on like Wednesday or Thursday, and then continuing to work on what I sucked at then into the weekend, and then do another mock on Sunday. And I think a twice weekly mock really helped, trying to do it with different people to emulate as best as possible the interview environment and the stress that inevitably comes when you walk into one of them. But then I think overall, the last thing was just like having very, very low expectation of how fast I was going to get stuff, how fast I was going to understand it, and how fast I was going to improve. And I knew that I had about 8 to 12 weeks from the start of that recruitment cycle to when I would potentially get an interview. And so using that as the reference point for, okay, I need to study all this stuff by 8 weeks. I need to fully understand it, get all these questions right, finish these guides, blah, 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 in addition to all these other things, really helped sort of structure my my studying appropriately. And then I baked in some like redundancy in that, like as I'm having very low expectations. Like, so if I spend 5 hours a day for 5 days a week, then I'll probably finish it in 4 weeks. So I need to do 3 more weeks of revision after that to actually understand. And then 1 week of like full on just mock, 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 mock. So having a plan, like planning the dive and then diving the plan, I think was the best thing that I did for myself. And then always continuing to revisit the frame of where do I stand versus peers? How are they doing versus me? How long are they studying? And I think that really helped humble me in many moments where I was like, I'm good on technicals. It's like, I don't think so, Matthew.
I see. And it takes a lot of humility to admit that to yourself, really, especially when you're putting just dozens of hours a week into something. You're basically treating it like a job, right? And that's how it is when you're going through it. But I like your point that it helps to have the plan. If you have a structure of knowing more or less what your timeline looks like, you can break things down into manageable chunks that are still going to be a lot of effort. But it's like, okay, today's a Tuesday. Today I'm studying M&A questions related to accretion dilution or whatever the case is. And then, okay, Wednesday, I'm going to do this. And then the important thing too that I heard you say is you revisit these concepts. You don't just study them once or a couple times and say, you know what? Okay, I'm good. I need to move on to the next thing. And there's, I think, a psychological tendency to want to do that because there is such a large volume of information. We often want to trick ourselves into saying, oh yeah, I've already covered that. I just really want to get to the rest of it. But no, true learning comes from digestion, spaced repetition, those kinds of concepts, and actually slowing down to spend time really helps. I remember for me last summer, I had my schedule of just, all right, I'm going to do 2 questions today and I'm going to spend at least half an hour and I'm just going to really dive into those. And that was enough, you know, and then I sped up a little bit gradually as I got closer to recruiting season. But it's amazing how much you can learn over a long period of time if you really do take that time and just be consistent. Like, it sounds like you were incredibly consistent and also making sure that you were putting in more work than you knew that your peers were doing, which is awesome.
Yeah. I think your point on like the humbling yourself to identify the true errors in your thinking is so important, because it is really hard to, like, you get the answer right, you can do the question, and then like that little part of your brain goes, okay, well, like, do you understand this? Like, if that word was changed, you know, would you still be able to get it? And I know, because I for many years, like, I ignored that voice and I was just like, I got it right, and it would always come back to bite me. And so at that, and I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? You spend 30 minutes a question, you probably don't want to. You're like, dude, I got it already. But yeah, really listening to that and like, I think was super helpful and is something that I tell all my students. It's like, you have to humble yourself and you have to keep very careful track of when you feel that internal sort of like tension of, do I really know this?
Yeah, it's true. It's true, Matthew. And I hope that everyone watching and listening takes heed to that advice, because unfortunately, like, I don't know if you've heard them, I've heard horror stories, people being in interviews, getting asked a question that they thought they knew, but it was just slightly different, and then they just freeze. And it kind of kills the confidence within that interaction, because it's like, you know the surface level, but you need to dig deeper and get down to fundamental principles. Then you can build that knowledge back up to specific situations where you have the mental agility to just like go for it whenever someone asks you a specific question that technically you haven't heard before, but you understand the principles and the concepts because you've done those reps, that you just go for it flawlessly. So I think that's a great point. I want to continue on with your story. So you were doing all these reps, and then what is it that led to getting the interview invite for Molus?
So over that time, like over that, those 3 months, three and a half months, so 3 interviews. So first was with Point 72, then it was Evercore, and then Molus. And so with Point 72 is through a case competition that we had won. And then through Evercore, it was that blast to senior MDs. That interview ended very poorly. Because like they asked me, tell me about yourself and why Investibanking, why Evercore? So like like a compound question of all three, and I prepared for that. And so I kind of like blanked on that. And then as you were saying, you get one thing wrong, like terribly, the momentum and sort of your energy is just killed for the rest of the interview. And so the rest of it didn't go well. But for Molus specifically, it was, again, going back to that frame of like, if I do more, I will be better. I networked with about 5 people from the New York office and about 8 people from the LA office. And it was sort of coming to the time when applications were going to open, that I realized like, I haven't talked to the one UBC guy at the Molus LA office. And he was an executive director. And I knew that I just sort of had this internal thing. I was like, dude, I got to talk to him. Like, I'm from UBC. Like, come on. And so emailed him, didn't reply. Follow up a week later, didn't reply. Follow up another week later, doesn't reply. Replies 2 days after that follow up. I'm like, okay, great. Let's do it. It's been 3 weeks of waiting. Reply. He doesn't reply. Just like, come on. Follow up a week later, doesn't reply. And I wait one more week. Like, come on. He finally replies to that. We talk. It goes well. And when I interviewed him at the Super Day, or with him on the Super Day, he was like, you know, Matthew, like one of the things that made me want to like get you in the process, because he was heading the undergraduate recruitment, was like your follow-ups and your diligence there. And most people don't do that. And I was like, let's go.
Yes.
So, yes. Yeah. So I think that was, plus like all the other people I talked to, was what contributed to getting that first round. And of course, I know for sure that the firm keeps like an internal tracker of the coffee chats they have with students, especially as it nears the recruitment cycle. So I think those other chats have gone well as well. But placing a lot of focus on like, dude, like, don't stop with three, like, because that's the typical sort of aim. Like, talk to 3 people. So why not talk to more, as long as I'm not coming off as like impolite, right? And I think the way to view that concretely would be, are you emailing, you know, more than like 3 to 5 people at the same level in the same office in the same week? And I've heard stories of like people emailing like 5 people, analysts in one office, and like one of them replies with like, hey, you can't do that. It kind of rubbed people the wrong way. So again, going back to that frame of like, hey, well, 8 weeks out or 12 weeks out, these are when the interviews will be. How do I, like, if I want to talk to 10 people from Molus using the conversion rates, right, like 2%, it's like, okay, well, I need to send these many emails, follow up this many times, right, and do this many people this week, every single week, at these levels. So again, being very orderly with that. I think it was mainly the diligence with following up with that executive director, and his awareness of the amount of other people I talked to was what really was the nail in the coffin.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm curious, how did you know when to follow up and when to move on and send the next email to the other person? Because I think you're touching on something that's kind of a fine line there, right? Like different firms and different offices, even within firms, have different cultures and they have different perceptions of what's annoying and what's professional and what's considered like a go-getter mentality. And you were rewarded for that, right? How did you discern that distinction for yourself? Because I think that a lot of people struggle with that is, you know, like, where am I crossing a line? Where am I not? Obviously, you're trying to get the foot in the door, but what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, because it is a very like sort of sensitive thing. I mean, if you rub them the wrong way, it's like, that's it. So I think one, being very cognizant of, or being very explicit with like removing blame from them. So whether it's, hey, this probably got lost in your inbox, whether it's, hey, you're probably busier, like, you know, extremely busy. Hey, like, I don't want to be more annoying than I should, right? And then providing a reason for why you want to reach out, something that's seemingly genuine, doesn't, like, it could just be, well, I want to talk to people, but like, hey, I've talked to these people, and so I'd really love to get your perspective. Or, you know, saying something about their background that like is something you're fond of and you've experienced with, as a means of justifying your interest in them. But I think it also, and so that's one, the big mistake that I see with students is like, their follow-ups are just plain emails. Like, hey, just wanted to check if you had availability this week. I sent you an email last week. And it's like, dude, like, they're not obliged to talk to you. So something like, hey, I, right? You know what I mean, right? So it's like, say, hey, there's probably a loss in your inbox. You know, I know you're probably really busy. So, you know, if it was even just 5 or 10 minutes, I'd love to chat to hear about your background, you know, especially your something about their background, right? Because I've something that you know, is a commonality. And I think that combined with the proper cadence for the follow-ups is what allows you to follow up knowing that you're not being annoying. And I think the cadence is probably the most important because if you follow up every single week, like for like 5 weeks, it's like, dude, no one likes that. Like they're ignoring your emails. So what I sort of did was first follow-up is a week after the initial email. Reasonable. Second follow-up, depending on proximity to my perception of when like deadlines would come out or when applications come out, I would either do 1 or 2 weeks. Now let's go with 1. So third week, you've sent 3 emails. Then every single week, every single follow-up from then on would be an extra week. So from that third week onwards, I'd wait 2 weeks for the next follow-up, then 3 weeks for the next follow-up, then 4 weeks. And then after a month, it would be like 3 months or 6 months. Now, I've never followed up that over that sort of a time frame, but that would be what I would do. And I think having a cadence that you can follow also necessitates that you get prepared early, because you're not going to get enough follow-ups in if you just start networking right before the deadline. It's like, okay, like good luck following every single day with them, right? So starting early and removing the blame from them and then having a proper respectful cadence, I think is probably how I followed up with no fear of like, this might rub them the wrong way.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. Those are excellent suggestions. I think you put it really well. You can be professional and be diligent in your pursuit of making a connection without being annoying. It's just that you need to do your work on the front end to prepare. And like you said, being early is a big part of that so that you have the time to kind of space things out if and when people don't respond, which of course most people won't. But I'm curious, yeah. Did you find a lot of success for those who did respond to you? Obviously we have that Molus example. Are there other examples of people reaching out more so after the first follow-up, second follow-up? Did you notice any trends or patterns there, or was it kind of all over the place?
I noticed that if you, like, you can probably, let's call it, you know, a 5% response rate on your initial email. You can probably bump that up to like 10 to 15. If you, so basically, doubling it by two, like going up 200% on your conversion, if you followed up like 2 times. That's what I found. And so, yeah, like the devil is buried in the follow-ups. And so I think that's something that like I've seen with students in the program that I've heard from my peers who've also followed up diligently. But I think, you know, when you hear like, oh, a 5% response, that's like super low. It's like, yeah, but like, think about how many other people are emailing them. And then again, if we go back to the frame of how do I stand out as a candidate? Most people aren't going to follow up. So if you follow up, you already stand out. And they're more inclined to talk to those who seem to stand out, right? Whether it's the resume in some cases, right? Whether it's the school you're from in some cases. And in this case, it's just sheer diligence. So I think that's sort of how I think about it. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you, Matthew. That's great. And I'm sure that people listening to this are going to get a lot of value from that. Last thing before we wrap up, I just want to touch on your interview itself with the IB position you ended up landing. Any insights there from those conversations, whether your first round, super day, anything that helped you or things that you noticed that helped you cross the finish line once you had initially gotten into the process?
Yeah. Yeah, I think being like one, practicing on Zoom a lot, so like knowing exactly how I'm coming off on Zoom, my body language, and just sort of what I'm comfortable with. I think some other hacks would be, well, you know, if you have a pen and paper, like practicing with it, and then, you know, if you have to, and that just helps with you, like practicing using it without like looking down, right, would be helpful. But I think the main things really come back to sort of what can I do to stand out? And so whether it's digging very, very deeply into my interviewer's backgrounds and finding that question that no one else is going to ask, whether it's sort of like sort of latent benefit of networking with so many people is when they ask why this firm, you know, I drop seven names. No one else is dropping seven names, right? So that was something else that really helped. I think it, like, some students just sort of freeze up in interviews and don't let sort of that, like, who they really are come out, or, you know, the tone of the interview is not exactly what they want it to be, but they're just sort of so stressed. And I think being very, putting a lot of effort into, okay, what am I going to say when I walk into that Zoom room or walk into that interview room? How am I going to introduce myself or make small talk? What am I going to talk about? Am I going to crack a joke? Am I not? Right? What joke should I crack if I do? What's been going on in Los Angeles that maybe I could talk about? Right? Well, how are their sports teams doing? Right? And so just really thinking about all these things. And then, so that was probably the first round. The super day, same thing in terms of digging into their backgrounds. And, you know, it was go so far as like, okay, look at their LinkedIn activity, look at all three posts, reactions, comments, right? Look into anything I can find, fifth page of Google, right? For one of the MDs, I was able to find like a deal that he worked on sort of independently outside of Moelis. And I'm sure like no one else asked him about, because I had to dig all the way through his like LinkedIn for it. And then being very, very cognizant of what I'm saying about my background when I introduce myself and how it sounds to them. So what one of my interviews were in the super day was like, I introduced myself and then he basically picked apart my introduction. It's like, oh, so what did you do in the military to do that? Like, how was water polo? Oh, so what did you do at this firm? Like, wait, walk me through that again. Like, tell me exactly what you did there. Like, he says on your resume, this third bullet point, right? So what was that? And so because I had combed through my resume and basically wrote a story for like every single bullet, wrote about what would my boss say about me? What were the positives and negatives in the internship? What did I learn? What would I want to change? Really allowed me to, I think, excel in those settings and show them that there's truth behind all that I'm saying. I think that's something a lot of students miss is, okay, when they do come up with these perfect behavioral answers or, you know, tell them about themselves, like, how am I coming off and can I speak to everything that I'm saying? And so the super day in some form is a bullshit test. And being able to pass that is something that requires a lot of work, but will benefit you a lot, benefit you immensely if you do it right. And for context, my last interview on the super day was sort of the most similar to a normal sort of first round, like behavioral technical, instead of, you know, conversational, talking about deals and everything. And in that interview, I failed a technical and it was like a super easy technical. I remember it was like, walk me through $100 of salaries and wages expense. I'm going up, right? And I did it and I did like salaries and wages payable on the balance sheet instead of just like, you know, a straight cash reduction. And I got that wrong. It wasn't like wrong, but it was like still wrong. And it's not something that you should mess up. But I mean, I still got the offer. And I think that was because in every single other interview of the five, and even in the other questions that I interview, I demonstrated a deep interest in the firm, a deep commitment to the role, and a thoughtfulness about sort of my experiences and what I want out of it as it pertains to the internship. And so I think those things really helped me.
Amazing. Thank you, Matthew. Yeah, and I think that goes a long way if you consistently show that interest, you consistently show how excellent you are. By the time you get to the end, if you mess up a small thing, it's like, all right, I know this person knows their stuff. It's forgivable. It's harder if you make that mistake on the front end and you haven't built up that trust. But it's, I think your case goes to show just very realistically what can happen. And it's okay. You know, it's okay. If you've done all the work on the front end, it'll eventually come out. So thank you for sharing your journey with us, Matthew. I really appreciate you coming here on the show. And as we wrap up, where can people find out more about you, what you do, if they want to connect with you? What's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, no. Well, first, thanks for having me on, Alex. I really enjoyed this. And you know, I love your podcast personally. So this is sick to be on. In terms of where people can find me, LinkedIn would be the best. It's just like type in Matthew Farquhar, same thing, Farquhar. And you should be able to find it. It's probably, you know, the only sort of big result there. I do have a YouTube channel under FR Consulting, but not as active there as I am on LinkedIn. So definitely, you know, connect. And reach out if you ever want to have a conversation.
Awesome. Definitely. Thank you for that, Matthew. And I know I've enjoyed a lot of your posts on LinkedIn. You just provide a ton of value just right out there. So thank you so much for that. And look forward to talking soon. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you. Have a good one.